Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine Podcast Radio. You're about to listen to an episode of Tech Done Different Podcast with Ted Harrington. Do you follow the pack or challenge the status quo? Join Ted as he explores how to succeed by going against conventional wisdom. You'll hear leaders in technology and security tell stories about how they achieve their success by doing things differently. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
Welcome to another episode of Tech Done Different. I'm your host, Ted Harrington, and with me here today is our special guest, Andrew Smith. Andrew, thank you for being on the show today.
It's a pleasure. Great to be here.
Yeah, so as the accent might give away, Andrew is hailing from Australia. He's certainly a very well-known and renowned leader in the retail space across Australia. And as we were talking about the premise of this show and how we serve readers, and I hear about, you know, the company that he has, it's like, oh, we have a lot to talk about. So, Andrew, you've got this company. It's called Think Uncommon. And as you gave me the teaser, you said there's an interesting story to that. So I'm curious to hear what that story is.
I feel like I've oversold it now, but we'll see how we go. No, so the concept was, like, in retail is an industry full of narratives. Like, there's so much being spoken about. It's an industry that impacts everybody every day. So it's naturally going to be, you know, interesting to people. And so it makes the news a lot. And there's a really, you know, annoying, if I can say, like, negative narrative around retail. And part of the reason we spun up the company was to kind of, like, work out how we can help retailers basically fly. How can we help them thrive and innovate and increase their rate of change and become better brands and be more successful and all that kind of stuff? And what we found was that, like, there's all these common things, like these really common answers. Like, nothing we say is that profound. Like, the answers to most of businesses' big problems aren't that profound. It's just, you know, how the hell do we actually execute on it is the problem usually. So what we found was that it's really common for everyone to know what to do. They have no idea. It's uncommon that people execute the how of how to do it very commonly. So very regularly, I should say. So hence Think Uncommon was born. We just wanted to be the uncommon side of problems, which is actually executing on it rather than coming up with the crazy cool ideas.
Yeah. Well, certainly that we're aligned in that. I mean, the whole purpose of the show is to look at things differently and explore where people maybe go against conventional wisdom, go against the grain. So I wanted to ask you about this idea that when you and I were chatting the other day, you mentioned this idea that you used to, you know, run retail for a big telco. And one of the strategies that you had in your role was to sort of push the CTO in terms of how to evolve sort of the company. And so can you tell me about what you learned? Well, first of all, I guess tell that story a little bit, but can you talk about what you learned in that experience in terms of aligning the technology side of a business and then other sides of the business and sort of what that collaboration, you know, what the key takeaway is?
Yeah. So, like, we were in this really unique position. So retail's in essentially an existential crisis, which is, like, you know, what do we think about channels? What do we think about digital? What's this, like, you know, digital transformation that we have to go through, this omni-channel appearance? Like, there's this whole existential crisis of what retail means. And retailers are essentially trying their best now to become technologists. And I was in a really unique position of being a retailer in a technology company, trying to convince that technology company to become a retailer. So it was kind of almost this inverse. And the chief technology office, who were, you know, a group of incredibly smart, capable technologists, were pushing us to think more and more about how we digitally evolve and digitally transform our business. And we, of course, had the customer in mind. We were obsessed with the performance we had in our current channels, how we turned up and how we represented the brand and told the brand story to customers in physical store, in physical stores in different and unique ways. And there was this tug of war that eventually we kind of realized was utterly stupid, because we were both tugging in the same direction but thought we were tugging in opposite directions. And a couple of the key reasons for that, well, the main one really was KPIs. Like, you know, we were looking at completely different reasons for existing in different parts of the business. So I was head of technology and innovation for the retail business at the time, a role that I did before I took over the retail operations. I partnered with Melissa Rallor, who was the head of retail technology for the time. So she sat in the chief technology, the CIO office, actually. And, I was sitting on the retail side, and we said, we have to do this differently. We have to come up with a different way to partner, to think about our respective sides of the business and to get stuff done. Because all we were doing is spinning wheels. Like, we were just staying completely stationary, not getting anywhere. No one was getting the money they needed. No one was focused on the right work. So we sat down we tried to disenthrall ourselves from the normal day to day. And we got out of the office, walked down the street and had a lunch and decided how we would fix this, how we would think differently about partnering. You know, historically, it's like, hey, we have a need. Here is the need. You go away and come back with a 40-page document of business requirements, and I'll, you know, read through them, or at least pretend I'm going to read through them and tell you that you've got it all nailed, and you go off and build it and then give it to me. And I go, well, that doesn't work. And then we wasted all this time and money. That's kind of how historically it always happened. And we said, how do we fix that? And we decided that we would become utterly symbiotic. And she leapt. Like, this was really uncommon for technologists at the time. So she, you know, jumped off this cliff with me, and we were building the plane on the way down. And we sat next to each other. We had a co-team meeting. So there was never a retail operations team meeting or a technologist team meeting. It was just one team meeting. We were one team. We aligned our KPIs. We had to petition HR to align our KPIs. We had to petition our bosses to let us do it for a start. She sat next to me in the office. She would come to sales meetings. I would go to technology meetings and talk, you know, and have a voice in decisions about what stack we're buying this week. I'm about to prove how little I know about technology. we basically just became a symbiotic thing. And I went on leave, and my delegate for head of innovation and technology for a retail business was the technologist. And she went on leave, and the head of technology in the CTO's office was the retail guy. And it was just this incredibly symbiotic relationship. And we flew. We rolled out innovation after innovation. Our rate of change went up. Our breadth of change went up. And we ended up building technology that worked so well for us as a business, our retail business. Our enterprise team ended up productizing it and selling it to retail customers. So it was just this incredibly fruitful time, and it all came from thinking about the relationship between technology and the business, rather than, you know, the gaps, the differences. I'm preaching the unity message, basically. It's like, how do you come together a bit more? And it was incredibly fruitful. It was one of the best working relationships I've had in my career.
Yeah. So let's dig into how maybe people can think about how to maybe replicate that, because there's two parts of what I just heard you say that are really worth noting. So one is that there is, in many organizations, there's this sort of cultural gap. You've got the technologists on one side and you've got everyone else on the other side. So that's one sort of problem. And then the other problem is the language. Like, how do they actually speak to each other about what matters to each other? And there's often just a barrier, a real language barrier there. So, and I know that a lot of the people listening to a show like this are probably running into that exact same combination of issues. What would your advice be to those sitting on the technology side wanting to, you know, cross the aisle, break down that language barrier? How do they do that? How do they reach out to someone on the operations side and successfully make that happen?
It is really hard, and it's going to take time. But if you have the courage and the willingness to do it, there's some pretty simple things you can do. First up, come up with an aligned definition of what innovation means for you guys. Like, essentially, there's so many myths about what the term innovation means nowadays. We call it the rate and breadth of change. So it's in how Is an organization able to change at, you know, what pace can it change, and how many different changes can it be running at once, rather than any one thing in quotation marks. So I think having that kind of aligned definition makes a massive difference. So sit down, go for a coffee, break break the norm, get out of the office, get out of the normal meeting room, go for a walk if you can, go for a virtual Zoom walk, which I've seen happen, by the way. You can have good coverage in your area, but still, a virtual Zoom walk meeting, something that just breaks it down and makes it a little bit more human, and go in with the ambition to do good, not look good. And one of the biggest problems that we have, humans are designed to be A, incredibly efficient. So we try and kind of cut things out, and our brain tries to cut things out, which means we make assumptions about not only our actions and how they're perceived, but what the other person's actions mean. And you know, so be aware of that and kind of try and overcome that efficiency a little bit and start speaking in human language and start looking for that common ground, that common goal of what you're trying to achieve, which, depending on your business, should be fairly obvious. Like for us, it was able to go, we were able to say, who cares about, you know, our individual KPIs that are broken down by a business who's, you know, kind of tried to create the myth of an organization? You know, we are here for our customers, right? Our customers are twofold. We've got the frontline teams in our stores who need better tools to be able to serve customers and do a better job. And our customers at the end of the day, who we want to scream about how awesome their experiences are, whether it be in a store or on an app or online or over the phone. So how do we, you know, just focus the conversation around that end bit? Because that's the one thing we've got in common, and it's a language that we share. Mm-hmm. You can't put vernacular on that. So break it down, break the norms, get out of the normal working rhythms, but find that unifying language that can't be broken down by your own area of expertise.
I love it. There's two parts of what you just said that I equally want to go down, and I'm like, which lane are we going to travel right now? So the two are the idea of vernacular and assumptions. So maybe we'll start with vernacular, and we can come back to assumptions in a minute. So you bring up a really good point, right? Vernacular and using jargon and things like that. And anyone who's heard some of the podcasts that I've been on myself as a guest, or I might have even mentioned this in previous episodes I've talked about, but there's such a jargon problem in corporations. And I was asked the other day this question that was like, how do they, I forget exactly how it was phrased, but it was something like, how do we deal with digital transformation in order to empower stakeholders to synthesize action? And I'm like, speak English. What, like, what are all those, like, what are you doing?
Oh my, that's like such corporate rubbish, right? I remember I was inducting an incredible team member into my team at Telstra at once. And I said, here's the jargon buster, you'll need it. It's essentially an internal intranet search function that enables you to type in something you might hear in a meeting and it'll explain what it is. And she just turned to me and said, why don't you just not use jargon? Crap. Good point. Yeah, we should probably do that. Yeah. Vernacular is so important. Like, I think if you can break, let me rephrase that actually, you can break anything down, no matter how complicated it is, into simple human language. Everything can be broken down to simple human language. We choose not to, and we do it for a multitude of reasons. It depends on you. It depends on your personality type. And all of these personality types are okay because they all have reasons. We all have reasons to be the people we are. We either do it because we feel, you know, that's just what we've learned, and we don't have the, you know, our brains aren't trained to think, you know, empathetically about the other person and their ability to understand the jargon. Because I've learned it, I know it, so it just comes out. I don't have that filter. Again, that's okay. We've all met those people. There are other people who actually do it because they have an ego problem. They're a little worried about how they represent, and they want to sound smart because they think that's what matters in the corporate world. So I use jargon to try and make myself sound smart. Mm-hmm. And then there are just people who, you know, have picked it up. It's, you know, the way we do things around here. So therefore we speak in jargon. And, you know, there's either a combination of those three or, you know, one of them that's prevalent, but, you know, none of them can't be overcome if you don't pay attention to it. You just think about how you break it down into simple language. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, I'm lucky enough that I'm a bit of a nerd, and I got really into understanding how the CTO office worked, how they thought about infrastructure and all the new things that were coming out. And I got into the detail because I wanted to. I'm just naturally curious about that stuff. But then I was able to then take that and use my, you know, my skills that I learned on the shop floor, which is you have to take an incredibly complex thing like telco products and break it down to simple human language for great Auntie Gladys, who's trying to work out which mobile phone plan to be on or which phone to choose. So, you know, I learned that skill on the shop floor, and I'm really lucky to have had it when I tried to translate what technology means for, you know, our strategy. Everyone can do that. You just need to kind of be conscious of it, be aware of it, and try and change it. So for me, it's just like, break it down to simple human language and, you know, call yourselves out about it. We had a rule in our team, which was if someone doesn't use simple human language, everyone, no matter who you are, no matter what your, you know, quote unquote rank is, you can call them out and say, that's jargon, let's stop, and pull it back to simple human language. And it helps because it just levels the playing field for everyone in the room.
Yeah, man, you're so spot on. I mean, the what jargon really does is jargon is exclusionary, right? Mm-hmm. It's, I mean, you nailed it when you said it's to make yourself feel smart, which really comes actually from a sense of lack of confidence, where it's like, oh, I gotta make people think that I'm smarter than they are by using words they don't understand to form sentences that they have difficulty deciphering. And somehow that translates to I'm intelligent. And it doesn't actually work that way. It kind of does the opposite.
Exactly. And like, you sit in a room and like humans are designed for this. It's an evolutionary instinct. It's not a fault. It's just an evolutionary thing that we have, which is we need to feel like we have value and we're adding value. And sometimes that manifests in incredibly unhealthy ways. You know, that means that we sit there and go, oh man, I'm going to talk about the ins and outs of, you know, this piece of technology so that everyone knows that I'm bringing something of value to the conversation. Whereas actually for most people, the most value you can bring is when you do break it down and make it useful for everybody in the room. Otherwise, we're just wasting our time in meetings where we're all talking in our own language. And then we all, you know, exit the room and go, I don't know what just happened. I don't think I'm clear on my actions, but I'll just keep running at my thing. And then bureaucracy wins.
Right, right. Yeah, it's funny that we're talking about this particular topic area. It's one of the things that I found when I was writing my book was, you know, I write this book about this incredibly technical, incredibly complex, incredibly confusing topic area. And I wanted to make it accessible. And so the challenge that I was facing was, how do I do that? How do I take this thing that is like requires pages and pages of glossary definitions of terms and then translate it into something that you can understand? And the tip that I was advised on and is how I figured out how to do this. And I'm curious to what your tips might be. How do you simplify it rather than just like, don't use jargon, which is of course good advice, but how do you do it? For me, the tip was try to talk about things as if you're talking to a smart, curious kid. And so in my case, you know, fortunately my nephew was 12 turning 13 in the course of writing my book. And so it was really easy for me to like either visualize it or literally talk to him about some of these ideas. And when you think about it in that context, for me, that just made it so easy to understand what I need to say and how I need to say it. Cause it's like, I'm not going to say something like empower and synthesize and stakeholders and digital. I'm not going to say those words to my nephew. I'm going to be like, how do we deal with change? You know, that's how I would say it to him. And so what's your advice for how to, I mean, obviously reject the jargon, but is there an actionable, I mean, that is an action, but is there something that people can do in order to say, okay, once we've rejected the jargon, how do we keep it simple?
I think it really does depend on where you are in the organization, like that, what, you know, your political capital looks like sometimes. So I'm going to start for starters, like this book obviously is the one you're referring to. Wow. I've got it yesterday. It's a deliberate plug because you deserve it. I'm not a technologist. I get into it, but I'm not a technologist by any stretch of the imagination. You use human language beautifully. And I think one of the best ways you do it is the lie and the truth way that you introduce certain topic points, because it kind of breaks it down to, all right, like this is, you know, I think one of them was like, you know, penetration testing. It's like, that probably doesn't mean what you think it means, which I'm not going to lie. At first, I thought you were making an innuendo, but then I worked out what you actually meant. It's beautiful. Like, it's just a beautiful use of an example of where you can take a complicated topic and make it simple. And the best way to do it is storytelling. So the actionable thing, of course, reject jargon, take away jargon. It's like, it's just pointless. It's poorly designed and we should reject it as a society in all forms. The other actionable thing you can do though, of course, is is just think differently about the way you tell and present your information. And, you know, humans are designed to be storytellers. Our whole culture is built. We're a pack animal. If we break ourselves down, we're a pack animal that's evolved the ability to communicate, and we've done it through storytelling. And storytelling is engaging. It's wonderful. It excites us. It energizes. It makes us emotional. Sometimes it bores us, which is still an emotion. But what it does is it kind of equates everybody in the room. And if you can take what you're talking about, find the one thing that is unifying, which for most businesses is the end point. So, you know, in retail, it's really, really simple because it's the customer. It's like, sure, I understand what you're talking about. Let's break it down again. How does that change the way the customer does something? And we all kind of get it then. And it can really level the room in a way that's healthy and promotes more helpful discussion. If you're a leader, humanize yourself, show humility, and you can make even bigger an influence. Because, you know, some of the more powerful moments in meetings, even on stage, if I'm presenting to the whole company, which is, you know, tens of thousands of people, if a technologist mentions something, I will say something like, I'm a humble shopkeeper. Could you just break that down for someone like me? And, you know, people don't disrespect me for saying that, but it does mean that the conversation's forced to go a different way, to equate it to everybody in the room, regardless of their background, regardless what they know. And so, you know, you have different things, different levers you can pull depending on where you are in the organization. But at just number one piece of advice is just use stories. Stories are just so powerful. Humanize them, break them down to the unifying point, which again, for most businesses, the end point. And you know, you'll be surprised about how quickly an equated room of people without jargon can be more helpful and productive.
And I love the way you, first of all, that advice is fantastic. I completely agree. The power of storytelling. It's just, we're hardwired. That's how knowledge and information was transferred from the days we were in caves to today. It's literally about survival is storytelling. And I like the way that you just described the idea of humanize yourself. It made me think of a friend of mine who's this very successful author, very successful speaker, and his whole thing is when he gets up on a stage, the first thing he wants to do is humanize himself. And so that he taught me that. And so now when I get on a stage, I try to figure out, like, how do I relate to this audience? How do I break down, like, here's this speaker coming to give a speech, to more like, oh, here's Ted here to tell us some stuff. Like, that's how I want people to think about me. So what have you seen that works for people to humanize? Like, the example that this friend used was that when he would get introduced, he gets this like glowing, you know, our best-selling author and, you know, head of this and chief of that and award-winning this, you know, he gets this whole thing and he'll turn and he'll say, I kind of wish like my mom was here to hear that. That's and it relates because everyone's like, oh, I also wish my mom could hear me get accolades in public. Like, that's cool. And all of a sudden they're like, oh, okay, it's a human. What are some ways that you've seen people humanize, or maybe you yourself have done it that, I mean, the shopkeeper story, that's a good one, but what are some actionable ideas people could do?
I have a saying that I use all the time, and I used the company I worked for was a previously government-owned entity. So it had so much grit built up in it and bureaucracy, which, you know, it's a battle scar, right? It's something to be proud of. We've existed, we've thrived, we've done amazing things. It might stop us and slow us down now, and we need to think about getting rid of it, but it's never something to be, you know, ashamed of or treat so negatively like we used to. But for me, you know, you don't have to be serious to be doing serious work. So like, if you're up on, you know, up on a stage, something like that is always great. I've been known to walk onto, you know, the dancing to the song or whatever, you know, just little simple things. Starting with a story, starting with, you know, sharing something about your day. There's a thousand things. Again, if I take an example I learned on the shop floor, you know, this is a sales technique, to be fair, but, you know, a simple comment about something about that person that is unique and interesting breaks down the conversation and the barrier immediately. It means that I'm a human talking to a human. I'm not the nasty, you know, salesperson talking to the, you know, unsuspecting victim. If you immediately break down that barrier, you're having a human-to-human dialogue, which is what everyone craves. Everyone fears things that aren't just equal human dialogue. they hate either being talked down to, or they hate being, you know, felt like they have to talk down to other people. So, you know, it's just unnatural to us, well, most of us. So yeah, have a bit of fun with it. Don't take everything seriously. I can walk into a meeting that is about risk management, where we're talking about a major incident that happened, and it doesn't mean that you can't break down the barriers and be more human in the moment. And it can be positive. It doesn't have to be a joke. It can just be, hey, this is weird, isn't it? Like, we're meeting for this thing that I wish none of us had to meet for, but we're here. So let's all take a big deep breath. Let's realize that what we're about to do is really important, and let's run at it. Let's run at this fire and see what we can come up with. Simple things that just break the barriers between the roles, the ranks, the fancy titles, the experience, the age, the genders, the race, the everything else that is sitting in the back of people's minds and keeping them worried. Try and overcome that worry immediately, because you know, the conversation just becomes so much more rich.
Yeah, one of the things I've observed you do in our conversations, and I really admire and respect this, is you can be very self-deprecating. I mean, you certainly told that story, like, I'm a humble shopkeeper, as you're like this super important person of a, you know, tens of thousands of person company. So there's so much power in being self-deprecating, and the opposite happens for people who like lead with their ego. But at the same time, isn't it, well, let me say it as a statement, and then let's break it down, and I'll ask you it as a question. But to me, I've often thought about that idea of how there's so much power in being self-deprecating, but in order to be self-deprecating, it almost means you have to have achieved a certain level of confidence, or maybe a level of rank or a level of achievement, in order for you to feel like, I can do that. And so I guess the question to you is, first of all, do you think that that is true, or am I misreading it? And then the second is, do you agree with my assessment of being self-deprecating as a way to sort of humanize and break down those barriers?
It's a smart question and observation. I think like there are different ways to think about the way humans are behaving. Like, we project a lot. We're really good at projecting. And one of my favorite sayings, an old boss of mine taught me this, is, you know, we judge ourselves by our intent and others by their actions. So that we think about, you know, we know that we've had this thing happen to us this morning, or, you know, we're tired, or we're actually awake, or this, you know, we're feeling in a good mood, or we're feeling in a bad mood. We've, you know, I really tried to make this work, even though it didn't work. You know, we give ourselves all this leeway for our intent and what's going on internally. And then we look at others and we judge them by their actions. So it's like, are they present? How are they responding to this meeting? Are they blah, blah, blah? And like, so, and it's just incredibly dangerous. We need to assume more positive intent. And if you go into a room and self-deprecate and then make a joke about it, and then no one in that room knows you, it's unlikely that they're probably just going to go, oh my gosh, who's this guy? They're probably going to sit there and go, oh, thank God, I was nervous about this meeting. Or, oh, this is good, I like the fact that this person's doing this. Or they might sit there and go, oh, who is this guy? And you'll just have to think about, well, you're going to win them over in the next sentence when you start saying smart things. So it's like, stop projecting the assessment of one action on everybody, because every human is different. If there's one thing you'll learn on a shop floor, is that every human is different. No matter what, you can throw the same situation at 100 different people and you get 100 different reactions. And, you know, we have to stop making these assumptions about what something means in someone else's head. And if you are worried about it, then be transparent about it. Sit there and go, all right, that was a bit of a self-deprecating joke because I wanted to break down the barriers, everybody. Anyway, consider them broken down. Okay, let's move on. My name's Andrew. I've blah, blah, blah. My role is this, responsibility is this. Let's talk about what we're here to talk about. If you're worried about it, just be transparent about it. Radical transparency is a movement I'd love to kick off. Like, how do we just stop living behind this kind of facade of intent and just start being real in every conversation we're in? So if I'm stupid at something, I'm going to say, I know nothing about this topic, so I'm sorry, but I need you to break that down into human language for me. And that's okay, because I'm going to know something that you don't, and I promise I'm going to do the same thing for you. And I'm not going to make you feel crap about it. Anyway, I'm ranting a little bit now, Ted, because you're getting me onto these topics that I'm obsessed with. But it's like, how do you just make sure get out of your head and start assuming more positive intent in other people's heads, and be radically transparent, and you'll be surprised about how many people jump on board with you.
This idea of radical transparency, did you invent that? Or is that something that exists and I haven't heard of it before? Because I already love it.
I mean, I'll claim it. It's one of those things where, like, I'll be like, oh yeah, I made up this thing, and then like my partner, who's really good at bringing me back down to the ground, she'll probably go, "That was in a TV show we watched last night, you idiot." So, yeah, who knows? But it doesn't matter who invented it. I don't want the credit. I just want people to do it. So let's just not give kudos to anyone as invention, and we'll just all claim it. Claim it as a society. Open source. Yeah, there we go. If I was better at this, I would have said it's open source at the start. That's a much better joke than mine.
Someone is buying the domain as they listen to this episode right now. Radicaltransparency.io. So
yeah, exactly.
A lot of what we're talking about goes back to the fork in the road that I found myself at earlier. Should we talk about vernacular or assumptions? Now we can go down the other one. We can talk about assumptions, because so much of what you've been saying really does have to do with assumptions we have about ourselves or about others, and how these are so core to cross-team collaboration, and how technologists and security professionals can relate and work well with others within their groups, but also across the lines. And one of the things that's really interesting to me about assumptions is that, I'm a security guy, so like I always look at how is something going to be broken. And the sort of core tenet of any system is the assumption about how people will interact with it. And when the assumptions are bad, like, oh, no one will ever do that. Well, when someone does do that, what happens? That's really what we're always kind of thinking about. So when you think about assumptions and the way people look at things and how they make assumptions from your experience, I guess the question is, how are assumptions made? How do we identify the assumptions that we might not realize that we're making? And kind of what should we do about all that?
Wow, this is a rabbit hole, and I'm going to love being in it.
Let's go deep.
Yeah, it's good. I like it. We're about to give a really live example of our different life journeys right now.
Okay.
So assumptions are everywhere. Like, we are humans, again, the psychology of humans, we're evolved to make assumptions because we're a machine of efficiency. So our brain is designed to be as efficient as humanly possible. So, you know, part of that is assumptions and prejudice and all of those kinds of things that exist that we wish they wouldn't, but, you know, we're a machine. We can't, you know, will them away with a self-help book. There's so much more to it than that. The assumption that, you know, I used to always get annoyed with is the people who focused on the person who was going to do something wrong. So it's like you would build a rule for everybody based on the 1%'s actions. So it's like, yes, the 1% actions are going to exist. Are they bad? Like, are they really bad? Are they damaging to the brand? You know, are we, you know, really going to lose that much money if they do get away with this theft or this whatever? And if not, then why would we impact the great experience of 99% of people? So we make assumptions sometimes for efficiency sake, when actually we shouldn't. We just need to be careful of it. We are subjective monsters. So that means we have biases, we have, you know, things that we need to be conscious of and cognitively aware of, i.e. think of all the time, to ensure that we overcome any of those assumptions. And, you know, my experience in corporate life, both in a corporate and out of a advising corporates and smaller businesses, is that people make subjective decisions all the time. Subjectivity has its place sometimes. Intuition is important, but objectivity is commonly missing. And people need to start thinking more and more and more about how they can ask better questions. You know, little simple techniques like why times five, which I'm sure everyone's heard of, but the idea of why, be the five-year-old, the annoying five-year-old at the way back from the museum. Why is that? And just you get into the depth of something, and you'll often, you know, overcome a whole bunch of those assumptions, and you'll get to a much smarter place, much more objective place. But we also, we're terrible. We, you know, our processes are built around, again, efficiency. Organizations are the invention of us wanting to be efficient. You know, I have task to do. I will allocate said task to person. Person does task. So it's about efficiency. But with built within it all is the same thing, people making subjective decisions based on their area of the business, and they assume knowledge instead of being curious and going to ask questions. So you know, the rule of thumb to break it down is be more curious by being aware of your biases. An exercise I love to recommend to people is go and have a coffee with yourself every week. Don't bring a device. You can bring a notepad if you need it, but don't bring a device. Just go and reflect on what's been going on in your universe. Let your brain run and ask questions about everything that pops up. All the big experiences are naturally going to be the ones that pop up. Did I handle it well? Was I objective? Was I curious enough? You know, what was the impact of my decision or my behavior to other people? Like, be just have that space, give yourself that space and your brain that space to process the information. I mean, you as a technologist should know how machines work much better than me. You have to process everything, otherwise you're going to end up with a clog. You know, I don't know whether that's actually real in technology. You'll correct me in a minute, I'm sure. But
well, let's run with it.
And let's run with it anyway. The brain just needs to process stuff sometimes. So you've got to give it the space to process. And giving yourself that space to constantly question how well you reacted and how curious you were constantly through the big events of your day means that you'll be better. You'll be a better human the next day. Yeah, so it's a really good exercise to do it. But basically, you can overcome assumptions by being more curious, and you should try and come up with a way that helps you be more curious in the moment, which is really hard.
I love this idea that you're framing of essentially curiosity as a leadership principle. It's beyond leadership for sure, what you're talking about. But this idea that, you know, I think when a lot of people think about leadership, they think about authority and decision making and confidence and punishment, and like it's almost the opposite. It's almost like your job as a leader is to make sure that other people can be happy and fulfilled and successful and achieve their mission, whatever that mission is. And it sounds like what you're saying is a way to do that is to be curious, to understand the people around you and understand what motivates them.
100%. Doesn't matter where you are in the organization. You know, if you're a server on the shop floor, or if you're a store manager, or if you're the CEO, it's irrelevant in the retail game. You got to be curious in everything you do. And you know that I want to rant a little bit now on that leadership statement, because you are so right. It's embarrassing to watch sometimes how people misconceive what leadership is. We've built leaders up. You know, organizations and corporate organizations are kind of based on the military structure. That's how it evolved. And one of the kind of hangers on of that is that we think leaders have all the answers, make the decisions, and, you know, lead us forward. Leaders are just an equal in the team. Their job and expertise just happens to be leadership, or at least it should be. All too often, we just promote the smartest person. The best people in technology leadership roles that I've met aren't technologists. They're just really great leaders. They have a good enough expertise and knowledge to know what they're doing, have probably grown up in it, hopefully, but if they haven't, it's like their main job in that team is to bring leadership, not technology knowledge. They should surround themselves with smart people who bring all of that other knowledge. So yeah, leadership is just so misconceived nowadays about, you know, how many stories have we all heard or been a part of where, you know, you kind of bring a PowerPoint pack to your boss and you get it back with red pen all over it? It's like, that's the boss basically trying to be the boss, trying to fulfill this weird societal norm about what bosses are meant to do, which is, I know all the right ways to use headings and what words to put in them and what diagrams should be used. I did it. I absolutely did. If any of my team are listening, they're like, you did that. I'm like, yeah, absolutely, I did. Because we had a misconceived view of what leadership is. It's not about knowing the answers. It's about forming amazing, talented teams, giving them direction, giving them the space they need to be successful, which could be money, time, resources, external support, whatever, and then navigate, helping them, let them run, unblock things in their way, provide them support where they need it, play the political game and get, you know, bureaucracy out of their way, all of that kind of stuff. That's your role as a leader. It's not about knowing what the right color for the homepage is or the right way to code an app. Like, that's their job. They're the experts at that stuff.
Totally. Well, as we wrap up here, maybe one last question for you.
Go for it.
Pull out your crystal ball. Oof. And yeah, what's next? You know, as we look at the future of like where technology's heading, where leadership is heading, you know, you can kind of answer this question however it resonates with you. But, you know, for people listening to this show or trying to understand sort of the future of what is coming next, what do you think is the future for leadership or technology or the intersection of the two?
I really hope that the future about it is a much more blended relationship style of working. So it's, you know, technologists and technology is no longer the, you know, we're going to go off and create things that are really awesome and then go and try and sell our things to people. It's actually we work together to identify the most important needs, the most important problems to solve, or the most important opportunities to chase, and then we solve them in the best way possible, which is increasingly obviously reliant on technology and technologists and smart people who can do the things that either they themselves have imagined or another person in the business has imagined. I think we need to, I would love to see the future, and I think it is, I think it's evolving this way, but for rather than it be this technology is technology office's problem and business is the business office's problem and, you know, marketing's the marketing office's problem, et cetera, there is this much more relational style of working, of how we come together to solve problems and chase opportunities. And I think the best way to do it is just to roll up your sleeves and get into the other parts of the business. You know, as a person in retail, I would go into the ranges and go and see how cell towers work and go to exchanges and see how fixed line phone calls are ran. Like, I didn't need that knowledge for my business, but it was important. It gave me context for what I was doing, for my role within the organization. So I'd love to see organizations evolve that way. From a technology point of view, the biggest thing that I see from my customer experience lens and like how consumer trend and people, humans are evolving and the way they're shifting, the way they interact with stuff. You know, my phone and my device has become such an extension of me that it's no different to interacting with me as a human now. And I think the barrier of like, please come and use our screen and our thing is going to go, because I don't think humans are as good at or like that as much, or they don't tend to use it as well or as effective as we think we do. And our way of coming up with different ways that those extensions, those technological extensions of us as humans, are going to become the medium by which brands engage. So it's, you know, throw in all the technology stuff now, augmented reality, artificial intelligence, machine learning, all of that stuff that, you know, humble shopkeepers like me won't understand, you will. But I will be able to say, hey, I want to be able to engage with my customer like this. Help me understand what's out there that can do it. So it's actually, we start with that need, that real human value need first. Then we solve it with cool gadgets.
I love it, man. I have a notepad filled with nuggets of wisdom that you just dropped on this that I am going to share with people. So,
correct.
Andrew Smith, you are the man. Thank you so much for sharing your time and your wisdom and your expertise. I think you're really going to help people think and do differently. So thank you so much for being on the show.
No worries. It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Of course. All right. With that, we'll say farewell.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Tech Done Different podcast with Ted Harrington. If you learned something new and this conversation made you think, then share ITSPmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.